Good morning. Can you all hear me in there? All right. Life is good. Let there be light. Thank you, Carrie. It's good to be here this morning. Nice to see you all. I'm going to talk today. I'm going to base my talk on the Gandavyuha chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. So already you might be scared. And I understand, you know, sometimes I and other people base talks here on texts from the Buddhist canon. And I guess you could get the idea that you're like, oh, what we do here is we talk about old books. And that is something that we do. Wonderful. But it's really only a very small part of what we do here. So, obviously we are all just practicing, many people were practicing Zazen here. And, yesterday we had a racial justice workshop. That was practice. That was one of the things we do here. And, I had been to a couple of them because we had one for senior leadership and then we had another one, open one for the community, and we had our last one of this set yesterday. And so my practice in the morning was cooking lunch. So sometimes maybe we talk about old books or read books, and sometimes we make lunch. And then later on we were all setting up chairs. Practice! Somebody made this happen. Wow. So people do many different things here. One of the things that we do is engage with this textual tradition. But that's where the emphasis of this talk will be here today. So the Gandavyuha is the last chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And the Avatamsaka Sutra is really big and mind-boggling. So I've never actually read the whole thing. It's like 3,000 pages. It's massively repetitive and insanely psychedelic. And it's really weird because it's known for being very influential on Zen, which is like the most terse literary expression of any spiritual tradition you could ever get. You know, a lot of the stories you get are like two sentences. So conversely, this body of literature that was very inspiring to Zen is massively proliferating images. So anyway, we've been studying this last chapter, which is called the Gandavyuha, which means entering the realm of reality, in our morning study group. So it's on my mind. We've had just beautiful discussions. Sitting together and looking at how relating to the text relates to our lives and how we do our practice of liberating beings from suffering. So the Gandavyuha is basically the story of this boy. Well, you get the idea, maybe he's like a teenager named Sudana who kind of awakens to this aspiration to pour his life's energy into being beneficial. And he has a pretty deep aspiration, and so he sets off on a pilgrimage. And the Gandavyuha has like 400 pages of his pilgrimage. And his pilgrimage consists of going to meet different teachers. He's traveling around meeting teachers everywhere. And if you read Pali Canon texts, the pilgrimages that happen, the Buddha will be like, I walked from Vasati to the Jeta Grove. And, you know, I walked for a few days, and then I sat down, and I begged for lunch, and this guy came to me whose name was, I don't know, you get a name. They're very, like, conventional. And then you get to the Gandavyuha, and it's Sudana's voyage is, like, through massive realms of jewel-encrusted mountains and trees that are entirely made of wind chimes, like an entire forest. And the sound of every wind chime opens his mind to entering another dimension where thousands and millions of infinite other Buddhas are dwelling. And in every pore of each of those Buddhas is a whole realm with thousands and millions and billions of suffering beings that are being liberated just by the joyful intention of that very Buddha. which only exists in Sudana's mind at that moment. And so forth. You get the flavor. So, Sudana on his voyage, the basic formula is, someone says, oh, you should go meet this bodhisattva. You should go meet this bodhisattva who will teach you. And Sudana goes, and he goes on some sort of epic voyage to get there. And he gets there, he meets the person, and he says, wow, I'm doing this. And he lists all these practices that are like these enormous spiritual attainments. And then he says, but I have no idea how to really be a bodhisattva. And then the bodhisattva like talks about all these amazing practices and attainments they have. And they go, but you know, really, I don't know how to be a bodhisattva. You should go talk to Tim. Or whoever. They always send him down the line. There's someone else. So although his practice is sort of spectacularly deep and beautiful, and his aspiration to be of service is really great, and each one of these bodhisattvas is like serving countless people in a way that's very specific to how they relate to those people, he just keeps going. He just keeps going. And the people that he encounters, these bodhisattvas, are extremely diverse. So the first one he encounters is just sort of like some conventional, I don't remember who it is, it's like Avalokiteshvara or something, conventional, famous bodhisattva. But then it's like he meets just a young girl who's like sitting around like teaching thousands and thousands of people how to be well. And then, like, he meets this king, and this king is like, well, my practice is just distributing goods to people so that they have, you know, they can be healthy and they can be happy, and we make beautiful things so people can live in a place that's beautiful. And then he meets, like, a prince who's like, well, basically my practice is my dad keeps putting people in prison, so I'm helping people get out of prison. And he actually, that guy almost gets killed for it by his dad, harsh. And then turns into a night goddess. And then Sudana meets all these night goddesses who have these spectacular, beautiful attainments. So it's really, and then there's people who have chosen the path of homelessness, who are living deep in the mountains, whose expression of liberation is people come to them. So it's really various. Really various. And, you know, I actually almost despaired of talking about the Gandavyuha because it's so, it intentionally defies graspability. You know how you want, like, a nice piece of literature with, like, one nice phrase that you just really get? And it's like it almost avoids giving it to you because it says, no, you have to jump all the way in. But most of you are not going to jump all the way in. It's really worth doing. But, so it's kind of hard to just pull a few themes out, but I found a way that felt good to me. So the Gandavyuha is generally, from my view, it's privileging seeing through ignorance or delusion. So if we think that one of the basic models for looking at our practice, I like to use this from the Yogacara tradition, which is seeing that there's a gateway of afflictive emotion and a gateway of delusion. So we can meet our practice and enact our way of liberation through meeting afflictive emotion with mindfulness, with compassion, and we can do it through looking directly at our delusions or our ignorance. The delusion and ignorance principally and at root being that things can exist separately. So anyway, this talk and this text are going to emphasize that second side. So if that does not mean that the work of engaging with afflictive emotion isn't really important. It's just not the subject so much for today. And I'm sure you'll find opportunities to do that work as well. So this idea, so what we see over and over again in the Gandavyuha is how things are connected. How within one person's body, infinite universes are revealed. How within one person's practice, countless ways of liberation are connected. How the suffering and the liberation of people is connected in their interrelationality. So that's why I put this quote from Hafiz on your bulletins. Hafiz is a Persian Muslim poet. And what did he say? I have come into this world for one thing, to see the sword drop from men's hands, even at the height of their arc of rage, because we realize there is but one flesh that we can wound. And so here, speaking of privileging delusion, so he says, even though you're really angry, you could actually realize that everyone is connected and that you can't harm someone else without harming yourself. So on the other hand, another teacher might say, we need to deal with the fact that you're so enraged, right? So there's just two sides of how to look at the problem of how we suffer, continue to suffer, and produce suffering. And my guess is very few people here own swords. So we might not have to worry about, you know, actually swording somebody or whatever that's called. We may have to worry about, you know, the tendency to attack ourselves, the tendency to attack and try and control the people around us. I think we should also be concerned about how easy it is to not see how we are all connected, how the extremely disproportionate treatment of people because of their race within our criminal justice system is manifesting. And that's not separate from what's happening in this room. Seeing how the enormous devastation to our planet and the living things on it that is happening is not separate from us in this room right now. To see how the endemic or maybe epidemic sexual violence and oppression is not separate from us in this room. So ignorance is turning away from that. To somehow think like, oh, that's something that's someone else does or happens somewhere else. And Gandaviuha is trying to incline our mind to begin to see like, that's part of my reality. And I have agency within it to do something liberative. And this talk will not be, sometimes people go, oh, well, what do we do? Other people are giving you better instructions on what to do. And that's not really what the Gandaviuha talks about. But what it talks about is keeping inclining our heart back to see our intimacy with the systems of violence in which we live, the massiveness of the problem of human suffering. And it is the case that we have a system that is designed to make it easy for white people and for people with money to ignore it. So I believe it is incumbent on us to actively draw it into our consciousness and let it transform us and let it move us in a way that is more liberative, genuinely, for everyone. So I'm going to read you one of the more famous sections of the Gandaviuha. It's right at the very end. Sudhana has met Bodhisattva after Bodhisattva and had all these kind of amazing encounters, and he finally meets Maitreya, or not finally, but he's meeting Maitreya towards the end of this text. And Maitreya is the Buddha of future birth, is what he's normally thought to be. So by the way, this is pretty fantastical. It's also called Entry into the Realm of Reality. The thing is, like, we think we see reality, but we see something that is patterned by our habits of mind. There's something deeper and beyond, and we can continually open. So this is going to try and open us with imagery. So anyway, I'm going to read a fairly long, like about a page long passage from this. So get ready for a ride. Sudhana, you ask how a bodhisattva is to learn and carry out the practice of bodhisattvas. This is Maitreya speaking. Go into this great tower containing the adornments of Vairochana Buddha and look. then you will know how to learn the practice of bodhisattvas and what kind of virtues are perfected in those who learn this. Then Suddhana respectfully circumambulated the bodhisattva being Maitreya and said, "Please open the door of the tower and I will enter." Then Maitreya went up to the door of the tower containing the adornments of Virochana and with his right hand snapped his fingers. The door of the tower opened and Maitreya bade Suddhana to enter. Then Suddhana, in greatest wonder, went into the tower. As soon as he had entered, the door shut. He saw the tower immensely vast and wide, hundreds of thousands of leagues wide, as measureless as the sky, as vast of all his space, adorned with countless attributes, countless canopies, banners, pennants, jewels, garlands of pearls and gems, moons and half-moons, multicolored streamers, jewel nets, gold nets, strings of jewels, jewels on golden threads, sweetly ringing bells and nets of chimes, flowers showering, celestial garlands and streamers, censering, giving off fragrant incense, showers of gold dust, jeweled awnings, various arrays across the floor, chambers of jeweled promenades, rows of golden banana trees, statues made of all kinds of jewels, images of bodhisattvas, singing birds, jewel lotuses, lotus ponds, jewel stairways, the ground covered by masses of various jewels, radiant gems, and arrays of all kinds of jewels. Also, inside the great tower, he saw hundreds of thousands of other towers similarly arrayed. He saw those towers as infinitely vast as space, evenly arrayed in all directions, yet these towers were not mixed up with one another, being each mutually distinct, while appearing reflected in each and every object of all the other towers. Then Suddhana, seeing this miraculous manifestation of the inconceivable realm of the great tower containing the adornments of Virochana, was flooded with joy and bliss. His mind was clear of all conceptions and freed from all obstructions. Stripped of all delusion, he became aware without distortion and could hear all sounds with unimpeded mindfulness. He was freed from all scattering of attention, and his mind followed the unobstructed eye of liberation. With physical tranquility, seeing all objects without hindrance, by the power of production everywhere, he bowed in all directions with his whole body. The moment he bowed, by the power of Maitreya, Suddhana perceived himself in all of those towers. And in each of those towers, he saw various diverse, inconceivable, miraculous scenes. So you just have 3,000 pages of that kind of stuff. And that is not, that's actually, you know, not more over the top than the rest of it. So seeing, one of the things that stands out is there's this, if everything is like infinitely displayed within each, every other thing, but it's all distinct. It's not like oneness or everything's the same. Everything has its full characteristic, but everything is also completely connected to everything else. Diversity and unity, or as Shirto later says, the harmony of difference and sameness. When we fall into one side, we're missing something, and we tend to be falling into one side of seeing, between seeing difference and sameness. So this way of seeing, we're calling this the entry into the realm of reality. So saying the way we see the world, which for most of us is like a bunch of little distinct phenomena that kind of bother or support each other, to actually see that they're also completely inherently interconnected, is hard. It's hard, especially when like you think someone else is wrong. It's hard to just be like, yeah, We're in intimacy here. How can I put down this sword? Or when we want to see like someone else's suffering is kind of over there. We think, oh, I don't have a sword. But we're ignoring. We're cutting off. That's what ignorance does. It cuts off. It's a sword. So, those of you who are scientists or, you know, having a moment, maybe, dude, this is not very scientific worldview you're promoting. Science is a great way of seeing. It's a way of seeing that's principally based in seeing separateness. So it's based in the idea, which is just an idea, that there is an observable reality that's separate from you. It's a very valuable idea. It's helpful. But within the context of Buddhist thought, it's just one way of seeing. And interesting, ecology is kind of like the infusion of the idea of interdependence into scientific thought, because it's about seeing how systems work instead of trying to constantly see things in isolation. So, and it's amazing what people are finding out. Like, you know, people are like, a tree is like this, and that tree is like that. And now they're finding out that there's like this huge network, almost incomprehensibly complex, of stuff living underground, mitochondria and stuff, that are communicating, and they all co-evolve. Everything co-evolves. So ecology is a way of approaching science that is trying to move us towards a less alienated position, a less exploitative position in our relationship to nature. And it does that by emphasizing interdependence and interconnection. So, a year or two ago, I found myself in Washington, D.C., I found myself practicing meditation in a line of like 500 people outside a Smithsonian exhibit, because there were these three-hour-long lines to get into the exhibition of an artist called Yayoi Kusama. It's a Japanese artist. And has anyone heard of Yayoi Kusama? Oh, wow. This stuff is cool. All right, I'm going to help you guys out. So there's actually a movie coming out about her very soon that I think will have theatrical release. Anyway, I was attracted to her work because of this. One of the Chinese teacher who most upheld the Gandhaviha as being like the big thing is named Fatsang. He's known for being one of the great figures of Huayin Buddhism. And Fatsang was really struggling to communicate the ideas I'm talking about to the Empress of China, who was his student. And she's like, dude, this is just too out there. And he's like, And so he made a room with eight mirrors, octagonal room of mirrors with a mirror on the ceiling and a mirror on the floor to represent the 10 mysterious gates, whatever that is. And he put a Buddha statue in the middle and a candle, and he said, let's just go in here and look around. And they saw, reflected in infinite regression throughout space, themselves, the candles, space, Buddha. And she said, oh, I get it. He actually just made the tower that Sudhana entered. So I always thought this was pretty cool. And then I found out that Yayoi Kusama makes infinity rooms. So, interestingly, I don't want to appropriate her work. So she never references Huayin or Fatsang or anything in any of her work. But it is really striking, the resemblances of her work to this body of teaching. And who knows what that is? Did she hear about it? Did she not hear about it? People are kind of amazing, right? Didn't like Darwin and some other person like simultaneously kind of co-created the concept of natural selection? So this stuff happens. Anyway, so these rooms are amazing. They have little sculptures in them or lights, and they're mirrored, and you go in. Because they're really popular, you usually get about 30 seconds in them. But you can see yourself disappear into the infinite at the very moment that you see yourself infinitely reflected. So when I was talking about this at a retreat a while ago, and some people would come up and be like, this is horrible. I see myself everywhere. It's like a all me. Oh, interesting. And they want to efface themselves, right? They want to disappear. So that's just interesting to see how this touches us. And explore what that feeling is. But anyway, you can have this feeling of simultaneously disappearing into while you're being infinitely reflected in relationship to everything forever. It's pretty cool. Now, there's a really great one where you don't go inside. It's a exterior box. She has a few of these where you put your face into a little window and then you look into the space. But it's full of mirrors and full of lights. And there's one where it's four things. So there's all these people lining up. You put your face in, and suddenly you're projected into infinite space with three people you've never met in a really astonishing and radical intimacy. Wow. I have to admit, the sad thing is that a lot of people were just holding up cameras. And, wow. But I was still like, we're here together. And, the people's faces would just be, they get these crazy, the joy that Susanna felt when he entered the tower is palpable and immediate. And it's a joy that you can find in this place, and even in the silence of our most formal practice of just being together and seeing all the shapes of the bodies are so similar. The shadows on the wall are the shadows of Buddhas. And it's all here. So Yayoi Kusama was, she's made a lot of different kinds of work. Interestingly, she often refers to many of her works as works of self-obliteration or self-annihilation, which is interesting because they tend to be like these massive repeated images of oneself. She's also she's seriously mentally ill and has lived in a mental institution for something like 50 years. And I am really not interested in like sort of romanticizing mental illness or saying like, oh, mental illness makes you a genius or a great artist. I mean, having been a person with mental illness and serious behavioral health issues and an artist who was like, if I don't have these issues, I won't be valid. That was not helpful to me. And I don't think it's helpful to anyone else. So, also, I don't have those mental health or behavioral health issues anymore because I've been fortunate to have practice. And I'm more have a greater creative output than I probably ever had had. Regardless, though, so I just want to kind of frame this so you don't think, oh, it's cool. Yayoi Kusama's way of seeing, she's just like, this is just what I see. She's like, she has visions where suddenly everything is all these reflections. You know, she'll talk about like falling downstairs because the staircase is like disappears. So that sounds like it's probably hard for her. There's a lot of difficulty there. But at the same time, what the vision of the Gandhaviuha is that different ways of seeing have merit. We can learn from people who see things differently. And Yayoi Kusama is this kind of beautiful expression of someone who's taken her way of seeing and made something beautiful and used it to help other people see something beautiful. And each of us has this capacity. We have our own vision. It doesn't have to be quite so astonishing. Also, when other people have different visions and we just want to go, yeah, whatever, that's called the sword of alienation, cutting off, ignorance, ignoring. So, I want to try on a little practice that we very rarely have I seen engaged in here, which is a particular kind of visualization meditation practice. So, Zen really emphasizes radically, just our meditation practice is to be completely engaged with reality as it is now. and like whatever imagination we having going on, being like, oh, that's happening. But we don't usually go, now we're going to use our imaginative capacity and do something that we believe to be part of a liberative process. But that's what I want to do now. So, and I want to just use a fairly traditional method of visualization that is about visualizing supportive or encouraging beings and then hanging out with them and then dissolving our sense of alienation from them. So I'm going to invite you all to find a posture that's conducive to meditation. And in case it's not apparent, this, the Gandhaviyuha is laden with visual images. The idea is by reading it, you let those visual images transform you. Same thing as encountering Yayoi Kusama's infinity rooms. And we can actually see that we have this capacity within our own mind. So for visualization exercises, best to have the eyes closed. So unlike Zazen, this is very much about creating an internal state and really emphasizing the visual realm of reality. But let's just begin by perhaps establishing mindfulness of body. So just noticing the range of sensation throughout the bodily frame. Perhaps noticing sensations in the breath. And now I'm just going to begin to give you some invitations to visualize things. And for some people, visualizing is very easy, and they just, it's like when you say the prompt, they kind of see something. And for other people, it seems really hard. They're like, I don't even know how to do that. And just try and be soft with yourself. If it seems difficult, just sort of keep bringing your attention to the intention to visualize. And you may, it may be that it feels more like a cognitive imagining than a visual one, and that's just fine. Just trust your own process. So I'd like to begin by visualizing Vairochana Buddha, who's kind of the Buddha of the Gandhaviyuha, and we'll make this visualization simple. This is just a person sitting in a half lotus position, wearing a robe that's sort of orangish yellow in color. Person has kind of a light brown, golden skin, bald head. One hand, the right hand, is touching the ground. The mudra of touching the ground, realizing immediacy, embodiedness. And the left hand held up, just with the palm open near the heart, in the mudra of emptiness, realizing that nothing is separate or lasting. And we'll continue to build this visualization, so we're going to add some things. And just see if you can kind of hold that image. And then, just in front of and below Vairochana, we can begin to place some people who may be more contemporary, who are inspiring and supportive to us. And you can just kind of begin to accumulate your own group of people. And it could be just like family members, or it could be very famous people. I encourage you to populate this group with people that represent the great cultural diversity of our planet and our country. And these people are just sort of calmly standing or sitting there. So holding the image of Vairochana, touching the ground and upholding emptiness, and holding these images of these benefactors, just moving to their left or to the left of Vairochana and at the same level as the benefactors, just the seated Buddha Shakyamuni, the very simple monk, probably pretty thin because he begged for all his food, having abandoned a life of luxury. Just sitting as you are. And then trying to maintain the parts of this visualization you've already constructed, moving to behind Vairochana and at the same level as the benefactors and Shakyamuni Buddha, the Dharma. This we can just represent with books that contain teachings. The Dharma is far beyond books, and yet we can just picture the books right now. And then holding Vairochana, our benefactors, Shakyamuni Buddha, and the Dharma, moving around to the right side of the image at the level of the benefactors, Shakyamuni, and the Dharma. If you have any figures from Buddhism who you don't already have in this image that you'd like to put there, if you don't really know, you're like, I don't know Buddhist figures, so you can just picture perhaps a nun with just her robe, her shaved head, or any other. You might not know what Dogen looks like, but you can. His robe is brown. Just see if you can uphold this image. You may find that your attention wanes, or your attention may want to move from one figure to another, and you can just be aware, or you may be like, I'm not picturing anything. But just soften, it's okay. People's minds work differently. And now just begin to be aware of yourself in relation to these images, like in a real sense of space. So however you picture them, can be aware that your body exists in a spatial relation that's understood by how you're picturing them, by their scale. And if they seem very small, you could maybe move them a little closer so that it seems like you're all sitting fairly close together in space. And then with all these figures in mind, yourself, Vairochana, benefactors, Dharma, Shakyamuni, Buddhist figures that you find supportive, you can just begin to slowly let them dissolve into light together, mutually, into one radiance. Let this image dissolve completely just into a sense of light. see if you can begin to let the awareness rest down into the body, the posture and the breath. Opening up to sound. Allowing the eyes to soften and open. And let's just offer a bow. Close the practice. So there are some schools of Buddhism where this kind of practice would be like a big part of what you do. It's a very small part of what we do around here, just given my experience. But it has its merit. And I wanted to talk about it here because the Gandavyuha presents this resplendent vision of engagement with inspiring figures. But at the very end, there's something really wonderful I noticed. So right at the end, Sudana meets Manjushri. Manjushri is represented by this chap here, sitting on this tiger. I hope the tiger enjoys Manjushri's company. Now, I'm serious. I look at it and go, really? I hope they feel good together, you know, sitting on a tiger. But I can remember when I had a little child, sometimes he would sit on me, and it was like the greatest thing that could ever happen. So I like to think that that's the relationship Manjushri and the tiger are having up there right now. Anyway, there's all these really, really, really long chapters in this. Like, it's usually about 5 to 10 pages of describing the encounter. The encounter with Manjushri, which is the final bodhisattva, is 2 paragraphs. And Manjushri is just like, good job. Keep going. Good job. Keep going. And then he lists a bunch of kind of things about how Manjushri helps. The text lists how he helps Sudana. But the last thing it says is, Manjushri established Sudana in his own place. Just like right here. So what happens through this immense journey of Sudana being in all these places is that he's just in his place. This is what you see when you see people who are embodying Zen, is they're in their place. They're here. They know they have agency within it. They know that that placeness is something that's connected to you and to the whole. And their action flows out of that sense of placeness. And that's why our practice here may be to hang out for 45 minutes with the Gandavyuha, but it may be to cook lunch. It may be to set up chairs. It may be to rake leaves or just sit. Zazen is an act of profoundly just being in your own place. And when you're faced with difficulties, you can realize, I'm not running away. When you're faced with the difficulties of the world that look like they're someone else's, you could say, I'm here in relation to this, and I have a part to play. I have a part to play. What can I do for the liberation of all people, all beings, all lands? Thank you. So we have a few minutes for other voices. Other voices, yeah. Lily.
I know you said, like, once you're aware of this interdependence, you know, there's other people who will tell you what to do with it. I was just wondering if you could take it one step further, and I was going to give a little example. So my family is having this, my sister and my mom have been having this issue for like 2 years now, and it involves my niece and all this stuff, so it's intense. And I was very aware of my interconnected with it. Mm-hmm. Like I felt the suffering like it was my suffering for both. Mm-hmm. But the way that I, you know, went with that was feeling like this is a bad situation and they're both victimized by each other, basically. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I would interfere and I would do things that would make things more intense.
Sound familiar?
So when I sort of stepped back and said, this is between them, this is kind of their life, I guess that difference part, you know, and then I took on, like, dealing with my own feelings about it and what that brought up and what my issues were with that, then that kind of seemed to give them the space, when my attention wasn't on them and was on myself, that it gave, and my version of that situation, then it gave them the space to actually like work through it in a healthier way. So like things are moving forward, but only since I stopped, you know, kind of being all up in it.
So to speak. Don't get up all in it. That's Lily's advice. Yeah. Well, what I noticed there is, you know, at the core usually, so the question is, how does enmeshment or codependency relate to interdependence? And they're different. One, you know, when you get into enmeshment and codependence, usually what's happening is you have emotional activation where you think you can control other people so you can feel okay. And that's a really good way to just check in. It's like, is this about me? Once I'm trying to control you so I feel okay, you've got something to take care of internally. So you described a process really well. And let me ask you this. Do you feel like you had to, like, cut yourself off from their suffering to have this, or were you able to still relate to them and realize it was real but not have to get in their business?
I think when I stopped thinking I could feel their suffering for them and I felt my suffering about the situation, and then I just held like the best vision of who they are and what I think is possible and what I, you know, desire as an outcome, and more focused on the positive within the situation and like what I am grateful for within the situation, and then dealt with my own suffering about it. That's what seemed to work.
That sounds good. That sounds good. And, you know, the thing is, it's not a universal, right? So, I mean, a universal is like trying to control people is not something I'd recommend. But, you know, there are situations where, you know, we may have to intervene. That does happen too. But that's good. That's a good example.
Question about suffering. So, at what point does my acceptance of someone else's suffering, or at what point does one's acceptance of someone else's suffering as, you know, a natural thing, become cutting them off, cutting myself off from with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. One thing I can say is there's not kind of like an answer. This is something that has to be internally discerned.
It's in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And each time it's different. But having said that, one thing is I like to avoid the language of acceptance. I recommend framing things in terms of non-reactivity. This actually kind of pertains to the previous question. So the thing is, I want to be able to totally hear someone suffering and not, optimally, I'm not reactive, and that enables me to meet them. Once I'm really reactive, I am going to be more confused. But the thing is, I'm often reactive. That's okay. So then my practice is when someone brings to me suffering and I'm reactive, I need to be aware of this part. So this is kind of what I was talking about at the beginning of the talk. Mindfulness of emotion needs to be held in balance with mindfulness of these more like interdependence. Anyone else? Well, I'd just like to say We read like a really spectacularly beautiful passage from the Gandavyuha on Thursday morning. Like there were chimes and just kind of like I read today. And then I went outside and it's happening. It's happening. I mean, it seems like, ah, oh, this literature is so wild. And you go outside, you can feel it. You have the capacity to experience life with this kind of joy and this kind of engagement, this kind of continual. So the enactment of your vow to actually be present to suffering and liberate people can be one that is very joyful. It's that ability is there in you. And it's like a continual opening, moving forward, listening. Enjoy the flowers. Enjoy the flower trees flowering yellow. So we'll turn it over for announcements. Thank you all.